Chapter 4. Reforged. Phylum Secundo. The Seven Neverborn. When the War Master needed to dominate or awe petitioners, he received them in Lupercal's court, with its towering vaulted ceiling of muttering shadows, black battle standards, glimmering lancets, and basalt throne. But when simply desiring company, the summons was to his private staterooms. Axemand had come here many times over the years, but usually in the company of Morneville brothers. In his staterooms, the War Master could put aside that heavy title for a few precious moments and simply be Horus. Like most places aboard the Vengeful Spirit, it had changed markedly over the last few years. Trinkets taken in the early years of the Great Crusade had vanished, and many of the paintings were now hidden by sackcloth. A vast star map with the Emperor at its heart, and which had covered one entire wall, was long gone. In its stead were innumerable pages of densely wound script, together with fanciful imagery depicting cosmological conjunctions, omega point diagrams, alchemical symbols, trefoil knots, and a central image of an armoured warrior bearing a golden sword and glittering silver chalice. Those pages had presumably been ripped from the hundreds of astrological primers, crusade logs, histories of unity and mythological texts that lay scattered like autumn leaves. Axemand tilted his head to catch a few of the titles. He Who Saw the Deep, The Nephite Triptych, Monarchia Alighieri, Libri Carolini. There were others, with titles both mundane and esoteric. Some, Axemand noticed, were lettered in gold-leaf Colchisian cuneiform. Before he could read any further, a booming voice called his name.
"Axemand," called Horus. "You know better than to stand there like some poxy ambassador. Get in here."
Axemand obeyed, limping past haphazardly stacked piles of books and data slates towards the Primarch's inner sanctum. As always, it gave him a thrill of pride to be here, to know that his gene father esteemed him worthy of this honour. Of course, Horus always dismissed such lofty nonsense, but that only made these moments more precious. Even seated, and without the encasement of armour, Horus was enormous. A heroic Achilles or Hector, accursed Gilgamesh or Shalbatana the Scarlet-Handed. His skin was pink and raw with grafts and regeneration, especially around his right eye, where the charred ruin of his skull had been exposed. His hair was still bristly with regrowth, but the attack on the dome of revivification appeared to have left no permanent scars, at least none that Axemand could see. In the immediate aftermath of the ambush, the three Primarchs had withdrawn to their flagships to heal and recuperate. The Sons of Horus had levelled Tygen in a spasm of retaliation, murdering its populace and leaving no stone upon another to root out any other attackers. 5 days later, the War Master's assembled fleets set sail from Dwell, leaving the planet a smouldering wasteland. Horus worked at a table encircled by a curtain wall of books, folded charts, celestial hierarchies, and tablets of carven formulae. From the thickness of its spine and tabular aspect of its pages, the book that currently held the War Master's attention was a crusade log. Even upside down, Axemand recognized the violet campaign badge in the upper corner of the facing page.
"Murder," said Axemand. "An old tally, that one."
Horus closed the book and looked up, a strange irritation in his eyes, as though he had just read something in the log he hadn't liked. Puckered scar tissue pulled at his mouth as he spoke.
"An old one, but still relevant," said Horus. "Sometimes you can learn as much, if not more, from the battles you lose as the ones you win."
"We won that one," pointed out Axemand.
"We shouldn't have had to fight it at all," said Horus,
and Axemand knew not to ask any more. Instead, he simply made his report.
"You wanted to know when the fleet's translated, sir?"
Horus nodded.
"Any surprises I should know about?"
"No. All Sons of Horus, Death Guard, and Titanicus vessels are accounted for and have been duly entered in the mission registry," said Axemand.
"What's our journey time looking like?"
"Master Comnenus estimates 6 weeks to reach Moloch."
Horus raised an eyebrow.
"That's quicker than he originally calculated. Why the revised journey time?"
"With the ruined storm behind the fleets, our esteemed shipmaster tells me that, and I quote, The path before us welcomes our fleets like a bordello welcomes bored soldiers with full pockets.
Horus's earlier irritation vanished like a shadow on the sun. That sounds like Boaz. Perhaps Lorgar's rampage across the 500 worlds has been more useful than I expected.
Lorgar's rampage?
Yes, I suppose Angron is doing most of the rampaging, chuckled Horus. And what of the Third Legion?
Axemand was used to swift changes of tack in the War Master's questioning and had his answer at the ready. Word comes that they set course for the Halicarnassus stars as ordered.
I sense a but missing from that sentence, said Horus.
Axemand said, but the word did not come from Primarch Fulgrim.
No, it wouldn't have, agreed Horus, waving to a couch set against one wall upon which hung a variety of punch daggers and Quirinal cestus gauntlets. Sit. Take some wine. It's Jovian.
Axemand poured two goblets of wine from an amethyst bottle and handed one to Horus before sitting on the portion of the couch not obscured by the Primarch's reading material.
Tell me, little one, how are your Mournival brothers? Asked Horus as he sipped some wine. Fulgrim's power shielded us from the worst of the gunship's fire, but you...
Axemand shrugged, also taking a drink and finding its flavour much to his liking.
Burns and bruises, mainly. We'll heal. Kyber acts like it never happened, and Grail is still trying to figure out how the 10th Legion kept 3 fire raptors hidden for so long.
Some Dark Age tech salvaged from Medusa, I expect, said Horus. And Ezekiel?
He's about ready to fall on his sword, said Axemand. You were almost killed, and he blames himself for that.
I dismissed the Justerian, if you remember, pointed out Horus. Tell Ezekiel that if there's blame to be apportioned, the bulk of it's mine. He's not at fault.
It might help if that came from you.
Horus waved away Axemand's suggestion.
Ezekiel is a big boy. He'll understand. And if he doesn't, well, I know Falcus covets his rank.
You'd make the Widowmaker first captain?
No, of course not, said Horus, lapsing into silence.
Axemand knew better than to break it, and took more wine.
I should have known Medusan would have a contingency in case the White Scars failed, said Horus at last.
Do you think Shadrach Medusan was on one of those gunships?
Perhaps, but I doubt it, said Horus.
He finished his wine and placed the cup to one side.
But what aggrieves me most is the destruction the Legion unleashed in retaliation, especially the loss of the Mausolytic. Raising it and Tygen was unnecessary. So much there still to be discovered.
With respect, sir, it had to be done, replied Axemand. What you learned, others could learn. And truthfully, I'm not sorry we burned it.
No? Why?
The dead should stay dead, said Axemand, trying not to look over the War Master's shoulder at the ornately wrought box of lacquered wood and iron.
Horus grinned, and Axemand wondered if he knew of the dreams that had plagued him before the reattaching of his face. Those dreams were gone now, consigned to history in the wake of his invincible rebirth and rededication.
I never considered the dwellers truly dead, said Horus, turning to address the box. But even so, a man ought not to be afraid of the dead, little one. They have no power to harm us.
They don't, agreed Axemand, as Horus rose from his seat.
And they don't answer back, said Horus, hiding a grimace of pain and beckoning Axemand to his feet.
With a stiff gait, Horus made his way into an adjacent room.
Walk with me. I have something for you.
Axemand followed Horus into a reverentially dim arming chamber, illuminated only by a soft glow above the steel-limbed rack supporting the War Master's battle plate. Spindle-limbed adepts in ragged chasubles worked to repair the damage done by the Fire Raptor's cannons. Axemand smelled fixatives, molten ceramite and dark lacquer. Worldbreaker hung on reinforced hooks next to the left gauntlet. The lion-flanked amber eye upon the plastron seemed to follow Axemand as they traversed the chamber. Horus might have died, it seemed to say, but Axemand shook off the sensation of judgment as they approached a high-vaulted forge of smelting and metalworking. The seething glow of a furnace hazed the air. Only when Axemand followed Horus into the chamber did he see his error.
No natural light of a furnace illuminated the forge, but something bright and dark at the same time, something that left a fleeting succession of negative impressions on his retina. Axamand felt corpse breath on the back of his neck, and tasted human ash at the sight of a flame-wreathed abomination floating a meter above the deck. It had once been a blood angel. Now it was, what? A demon? A monster? Both. Its crimson armor was broken, cracked where the evil within it licked outwards in unnatural eternal flames. Whoever the legionary within that armor had once been was immaterial. All that remained of him was the scorched prime helix symbol of an apothecary. It called itself the Cruor Angelus, but the sons of Horus knew it as the Red Angel. It had been bound and gagged by chains that were originally gleaming silver, but had since been scorched black. Its head went unhelmed, but its features were impossible to discern through the infernal flames, save for two white-hot eyes filled with the rage of a million damned souls. "Why is it here?" said Axamand, unwilling to voice its name. "Hush," replied Horus, leading Axamand towards a timber workbench, upon which rested implements that looked more akin to surgeon's tools than those of the metal worker. "The Faceless One's aborted angel has a part to play in our current endeavour." "We shouldn't trust anything that came from that scheming bastard," said Axamand. "Exile was too easy. You should have let me kill him." "If he doesn't take my lesson to heart, I may let you," said Horus, lifting something from the workbench. "But that's a murder for another day." Only reluctantly did Axamand let his gaze turn from the Red Angel, as any warrior was loath to let an enemy fall from sight. "Here," said the War Master, holding a long cloth-wrapped bundle before him. "This is yours." Axamand took the bundle and felt the weight of strong metal. He unwrapped it with reverent care, guessing what lay within. Morn It All's edge had been badly notched in the fight against Tibu Khan, the White Scar's borrowed Medusan blade proving to be more than the equal of Chthonian blue steel. "Hard as a rock and hot as hell in the heart," said Horus, tapping his chest. "A weapon that's Chthonia to the core." Axamand gripped the leather-wound hilt of the double-edged sword, holding the blade out before him, and feeling a last part of him he'd never even appreciated was missing, now restored. The fuller was thick with fresh etchings that glittered in the demon thing's firelight. Axamand felt lethal potency within the blade that had nothing to do with its powered edges. "I need you and your sword, little Horus Axamand," said the War Master. "The war on Moloch will test us all, and you're not you without it. It shames me I was not the one to restore its edge." "No," said Horus. "It honors me that I could do it for you, my son." Archidon Cairo had learned a great many things during his time as a tech marine of the Ultramarines, but the teaching he'd taken most to heart was that no two vehicles were ever wholly alike in temper or mien. Each was as individual as the warriors they carried into battle, and they too had legacies worthy of remembrance. Sabaean Queen was as good an example of this as he could wish for. A stormbird of Terran provenance, it had led the triumphal flyby over Anatolia in the last days before the 13th Legion launched the campaign to reclaim the lunar enclaves from the Selenar cults alongside the 16th and 17th Legions. Cairo was yet unborn, but felt Sabaean Queen's pride to have been part of the Great Crusade's first true battle. It was a proud aircraft, haughty even, but Cairo would sooner pilot a prideful craft than a workhorse made resentful by poor treatment. He banked Sabaean Queen around the easternmost peaks of the Untar Messas, dropping his altitude sharply and pushing out the engines as the landscape opened up. The flight from the defence readiness inspection along the Ainatap Peninsula had been a long one, and the Stormbird had earned this chance to flex her wings. With brown hills and golden fields stretching to Iron Fist Mountain on the horizon, Moloch resembled a great many of the 500 worlds and was dotted with efficient agri-collectives and crisscrossed by wide roads, maglevs, and glittering irrigation canals. It had been brought to compliance without the need for war, yet, for reasons unknown to Cairo, still boasted a garrison force numbering in the millions. Ultramarines' boots were still fresh on the ground, newly deployed as part of a regular rotation of Legion forces between Ultramar and Molek. Vared of the 11th chapter had returned to Macrag with full honours, passing the Aquila Ultima to Castor Alcade, legate of Battle Group 2 within the 25th chapter. With the War Master's host said to be somewhere in the northern marches, there was likely little glory to be won on Molek, but few warriors were so in need of glory as Castor Alcade. Thus far, Alcade's career had been unremarkable. He had assumed the mantle of legate by dint of a service record that showed him to be a warrior of due diligence and requisite ability, but little flair. Under Alcade's command, Battle Group 2 had acquired a largely unearned reputation for ill fortune. Two particular examples in the last 30 years had turned arming chamber whispers into fact. On Varn's world, they had fought alongside the 9th and 235th companies to crush the greenskin host of the Genii Cluster. Alcade coordinated a gruelling flanking campaign, routing the feral greenskin in the highland latitudes before arriving an hour after Claude Empion had broken the enemy host comprehensively at the Battle of Sumei Delta. During the final storming of the cavern cities of Gorstel, a series of malfunctioning Auspex markers saw Alcade's assault through the ventral manufactories misdirected into dead-end arcologies. Hopelessly lost in the maze of tunnels, the absence of Battle Group 2's companies left Icos Lamiad and his warriors to fight the biomechanical host of the Saibar Makatan unsupported. Lamiad's heroically earned victory cemented an already formidable stature and led to his appointment as Tetrarch of Konor, while consigning Alcade's reputation, through no fault of his own, to self-evident mediocrity. It was said that the avenging son himself had remarked on the matter, saying, "Not every commander can be the proudest eagle. Some must circle the eyrie and allow others to fly farther." Cairo had his doubts as to the remark's authenticity, but that didn't seem to matter. Those who knew of Alcade's reputation named him Second String, Phylum Secundo, forgetting that by its original meaning, the archer's second string had to be just as strong and reliable as the first. A threat Auspex chirruped in Cairo's ear as a mountaintop battery of Hydra anti-aircraft guns unmasked and locked onto the Sabaean Queen. He sent a communion pulse, telling the gunners that he was a friendly, and the threat disappeared from the slate.
"The Untermesses guns?" inquired Legate Alcade, appearing in the hatchway linking the troop compartment with a cockpit.
"Yes, sir," replied Cairo. "A little slow in acquiring us, but I was making them sweat for it."
"A little sweat now will save a lot of blood when Horus's dogs reach Molek," said Alcade, strapping himself into the co-pilot's seat across from Cairo.
"You really think the traitors will come here, sir?"
"Given Molek's location, eventually they must," said Alcade, and Cairo heard the hope that such an event might come sooner rather than later. Alcade wanted war to reach Molek. He had the scent of glory in his nostrils.
Cairo understood glory. He'd earned his share of it. Such an allure was more potent than any apothecary's opiates. The power of its need was something to be feared, even by transhuman warriors who claimed to be above such mortal weakness. Alcade scanned the avionics display. His battle plate's onboard systems would already have given him the Stormbird's approximate location, but Ultramarines didn't work with approximates.
"So what's your verdict on the Aenotep Peninsula?"
Cairo nodded slowly.
"Fair."
"That's it?"
"It'll do if all they have to fight are mortals and Xenos, but it's not Legion strong."
"How would you strengthen it?" asked Alcade. "Give me a theoretical."
Cairo shook his head.
"In the Forge, we prefer speculative and empirical. All the potentials and all working actuals. Even the best practical doesn't become empirical until it's been proven combat effective a significant number of times."
"A subtle difference," said Alcade. "Too subtle for most when the bolts are in the air."
"That's why tech marines are so valuable," said Cairo, bringing them down towards the Valley of Lupercalia, a name that must surely be changed in light of the War Master's treachery. "We calculate how things need to be so the commanders in the field don't have to."
more range markers and hydras fixed on them, and Cairo let Sabaean Queen dismiss their interrogations with lofty disdain.
"What would we do without our brave brothers in the forge to keep us mere commanders in line?" said Alcade.
Cairo said, "Good to know you appreciate us, sir."
"Did you ever doubt it?" grinned Alcade.
"But you didn't answer the question." Cairo spared his legate a sidelong glance. As heroic a warrior of the 13th Legion as any, not even transhuman genhancements could smooth out his patrician features or the finely sculpted planes of his cheekbones. His eyes were pale aquamarine, set in skin like weathered birch, upon which he wore a waxed beard, forked in the manner of the Khan's sons. Perhaps he thought it gave him a rakish, dangerous appearance, but together with his tonsured silver hair, it made him look more monk than warrior.
"I'd bring in another chapter of the 13th Legion to stiffen its soldiers' backs," said Cairo. "Then more artillery, at least 3 brigades, maybe some cohorts of Modwen's Tharak cyborgs, and Titans. Can't go wrong with Titans."
"Always so precise," laughed Alcade. "I'd ask you the time, and you'd tell me how to build a watch."
"It's why I was chosen to go to Mars," said Cairo.
Ahead of the Stormbird, Lupercalia gouged into the mountains along a stepped valley of ochre stone. 6 kilometres wide at its opening, the valley gradually narrowed as it ascended towards Mount Torga and the Citadel of Dawn, where Cyprian Divine ruled Molech with an admirably stern hand. The city's walled defences were impressive to look at, but archaic and largely valueless against a foe with any real military ability. Previous Ultramarines commanders had done their best to alter them, employing the Primarch's notes towards martial codification, but they faced resistance from an intransigent population.
"I sense there's more you want to say," said Alcade.
"Can I speak freely, sir?"
"Of course."
"The problem with Molech isn't the emplaced defences or its armed might. The problem is the embedded culture."
"Give me a theoretical, speculative."
"Very well. The way I see it, the people of Molech have been raised on tales of heroic knights riding out to do battle in honourable contests of arms," said Cairo. "Their world hasn't seen real fighting in centuries. They don't know that massed armies of ordinary men with guns is the new reality. Numbers, logistics and planning are the determining factors in who wins and who dies."
"A grim view," said Alcade. "Especially for the legions."
"An empirical view," said Cairo, tapping 2 fingers to the skull-stamped Ultima on his breastplate. "Ah, don't mind me, sir. I was always best at envisaging worst-case scenarios. But if you're right and the traitors do come to Molech, it's not the army regiments they'll look to kill first."
"True. It will be us and Salikar's Bloodsworn.
We have 3 companies, and Emperor alone knows how many Blood Angels are on Molech."
"I'd say less than half our strength," said Alcade. "Varied spoke of Vitus Salikar being a warrior not overly given to the spirit of cooperation."
"So 500 legionaries," said Cairo, "and, hyperbole aside, that's not enough to defend a planet. Therefore, the primary burden of defending Molech has to fall on the army regiments."
"They might be mortals, but there's nearly 50 million fighting men and women on this planet. When war comes to Molech, it'll be bloody beyond imagining, and it won't be ended quickly."
"But in the final practical, mortals simply can't resist mass legion war, sir," said Cairo.
"You don't think nearly 100 regiments can hold one of the Emperor's worlds?"
"What practical would give you any mortal army resisting legion forces? Honestly. You know what they call it when baseline humans find themselves fighting warriors like us."
"Transhuman dread," said Alcade.
"Transhuman dread, yes," agreed Cairo. "We've both seen it. Remember the breach at Parsabad? It was like the blood had frozen their veins. I almost felt sorry for the poor bastards we had to kill that day."
Alcade nodded.
"It was like threshing wheat."
"Since when have the noble families of Macragge ever threshed their own wheat?" said Cairo.
"Never," agreed Alcade. "But I have seen pics of it."
Approach vectors appeared on the display slates in front of Cairo. Alcade fell silent as Sabine Queen began its descent to the cavern hangar just below the great citadel of the valley's heart. The chiming of threat warnings was constant, but Cairo shut them off as he brought the aircraft level with a booming flare of deceleration, followed by the jolt of landing claws meeting the ground. Alcade unsnapped his restraints and returned to the troop compartment, where 50 Ultramarines sat in banked rows along the aircraft's centerline and fuselage. Cairo powered down the engines, letting the Stormbird reach its own equilibrium before releasing the locking mechanisms on the assault doors. As the ground crew rushed to tend the aircraft, Cairo unsnapped his own restraints and finished the last of his post-flight checks. He placed a fist over the Aquila on the flight console, then made the Icon Mechanicum to honour both Terra and Mars. "My thanks," he said, before ducking into the troop compartment. Armoured in cobalt, blue and ivory, the five squads of Ultramarines were a fine sight indeed, mustered and ready to debark. The scents of scorched iron, hot engines and venting propellant blew in through the lowered assault ramp, a heady mix that took Cairo back to the forge and the simple pleasure of shaping metal. Gathering the equipment cases containing his servo harness, Cairo followed the line warriors down the ramp as landing menials and deck crew readied the Stormbird for her next flight. Didicus Theron was already waiting for them on the landing strip, and from the look on the Centurion's face, the news he bore was of a dark hue. A low-born scrambler from Kalth, he'd achieved high office within the Legion by virtue of saving the life of Tyro Nicodemus at Terioth Ridge, nearly 60 years ago.
"Grim tidings," said Theron as the legate approached. "Speak," commanded Alcade. "Cyprian Divine is dead," said Theron, "but that's not the worst of it."
"The Imperial Commander is dead and that's not the worst of it?" said Cairo.
"Not even close," said Theron. "The 500 worlds are under attack, and the Horse and War Master is en route to Molech."
Icy winds howled over the steel-dust hull of the Valkyrie, spiralling in ghostly vortices around its cooling engines. Vapour streamed from the leading edges of its wings and linked tail fin, making it look as though it was still in flight. Loken had instructed Rasur to keep the engine's fires banked to prevent them icing up completely. Though his armour kept the cold at bay, Loken shivered at the frozen desolation of the mountaintop. The Urals ran for nearly 2,500 kilometres from the frozen reaches of Kara Oceanica to the ancient realm of the Kievan Rus Khaganate. Ahead, the towering forge spire of Mount Narod Naya was a hazed blur, wreathed in the smoke and lightning of mighty subterranean endeavours. The riches of these mountains had been plundered by a succession of peoples, but none to match the monumental scale of the Terawatt clan. Said to spring from the same root as the Mechanicum, its theologitechs had carved temples into the bones of the Urals during a technological dark age, where they weathered the fury of old night in splendid isolation until their very existence became a whispered legend. When the Terawatt clan finally emerged from their lair beneath the Kolat Sayakal, it was to find a planet ravaged by wars fought between monstrous ethnarchs and tyrants. As word of the clan's rebirth spread, petitioners came from across the globe to beg for their ancient wonders, offering bargains, treaties and threats in equal measure. But only one man came offering more than he sought to take. He called himself Emperor, a title the clan Agas mocked until his vast knowledge of long-forgotten technologies became apparent. His willingness to share these lost arts allied the clan to his banner, and from their archives came many of the weapons that brought old Earth to unity. The entombed memory cores of its eldest Agas claimed it was their technology, not that of Mars, that precipitated the creation of the first proto-Astartes, a claim utterly refuted by the Mechanicum. Loken saw little evidence of technological wonder here, just a high ridge of black rock, swathed in freezing mists and blustering ash clouds expelled from the buried Dyatlov forge complexes. The rocks were bare of vegetation, sharp-edged, and utterly inimical to flora of any kind. Loken turned on the spot, seeing nothing but the solitary landing platform upon which sat the Valkyrie. He checked the slate he carried, its edges already limned with a coating of pale, fibrous dust. "You sure this is the place?" he asked.
"I have a hunter's eye, and I've flown from one side of Terra to the other on the Sigilite's business," said Rasua,
her voice clipped and deficient.
And I've landed at the Seven Strong Men many times, Garvia Loken, so yes, I'm sure this is the place.
Then where is he?
You are asking me, said Rasua. He's one of yours. Shouldn't you know?
I never met him, said Loken.
Neither have I. So why do you think I'll know?
Loken didn't bother to answer. Rasua was a mortal, but even Loken could tell there was more to her than met the eye. Her augmetics were subtly woven into a physique clearly honed by genetic modification and a rigorous regime of training. Everything about her spoke of excellence. Rasua claimed to be a simple naval pilot, but smiled as she said it, as if daring Loken to contradict her. Her inscrutability, skin tone, eye shape, and gloss black hair suggested Pan-Pacific gene stock, but she'd never volunteered any information on her heritage, and Loken never asked. Rasua had flown him from old Himalasia to the northern reaches of the Urals to find the first member of Loken's Pathfinders. But it seemed that was going to be more difficult than anticipated. The man Loken had come to find was Sons of Horus, and he... No, he wasn't. He was a lunar wolf. He hadn't been part of the Legion when he took that first step on the road to treachery. Not a true son then, but he was a gene brother, and Loken wasn't sure how he felt about that. Yes, Yakton Cruz was one of his fellow knights errant, but he'd served with a half-herd aboard the Vengeful Spirit when things had gone to hell. They had a shared experience of what their lost brothers had done that this warrior could never know. The wind dropped for a moment, and Loken peered through the stilled clouds of particulate matter, seeing dark outlines like towering giants frozen to the summit. Too tall to be anything living, they were like the heavy columns of some vast temple that had been eroded over centuries of exposure. He set off towards them, trudging through the wind-blown ash with long strides. The shapes emerged from the clouds, revealing themselves to be far larger than he had suspected. Great pillars of banded rock, like the megaliths of some tribal fane. Six of them clustered close together, none less than 30 meters tall, with a seventh set apart like an outcast. Some were narrow at the base, widening like spear blades, before tapering towards their peaks. The wind howled through them in a keening banshee's wail that set Loken's teeth on edge. Static buzzed in his helmet, a side effect of the charged air from the unceasing industry beneath the mountains. Loken heard whistles, clicks, and burps of distortion, and what sounded very much like soft breath.
Garvey.
Loken knew that voice, and spun round as if expecting to see his fallen comrade, Tarik Torgadon, standing behind him. But he was utterly alone, even the Valkyrie's outline growing indistinct in the fog. He was no longer sure if he'd heard the voice or imagined its existence. It had been an apparition of his murdered friend that had convinced Loken to leave the sanctuary of the Lunar Biodome, a memory that was growing ever fainter, like the fading echoes of a distant dream. Had that even happened? Or was it a reflection of guilt and shame caught in the splintered shards of his tortured psyche? Loken had been dug from the ruins of Istvan III, a broken shell of a man haunted by delusions and phantasmal nightmares. Garrow had brought him back to Terra and given him fresh purpose, but could any man return from such an abyss without scars? He took a moment to balance his humours as bleeding whispers of what might have been vox traffic drifted on the edge of hearing. Loken's breath caught in his throat at its familiarity. He'd heard this kind of thing before, on 6319. At the Whisperheads. Jubal's horrifying transformation flashed before Loken's eyes like a stuttering picked feed, and his hand dropped to the holstered bolt pistol. He thumbed the catch from its cover. He didn't expect to draw it, but just resting his hand on its textured grip gave him comfort. Moving through the gargantuan rock formations, the squalling static whined and crackled to the rhythm of the ash storm. Did the pillars amplify the interference, or was it a byproduct of the hundreds of forge temples below him? The static abruptly cut out.
"Do you know where you are?"
said a low voice, its accent guttural and hard-boned, with palatal edges and rough vowels. "Tarik?" said Loken.
"No. Answer the question."
"The Urals," said Loken.
"This particular mountain."
I didn't know it had a name.
It's called Manpupida, said the voice. I'm told it means Little Mountain of the Gods in some dead language. The clan say these are the petrified corpses of the Seven Neverborn.
Are you trying to frighten me with old legends?
No. We were born here. Did you realize that?
Continued the voice.
Not literally, of course, but the first breed of transhumans were made beneath this mountain.
I didn't know that, said Loken. Where are you?
Closer than you think. But you'll have to find me if you want to talk face to face, said the voice. If you can't manage that, then we'll not speak at all.
Malkador said you would help me, said Loken. He didn't say anything about having to prove myself.
There's a lot that crafty old man isn't saying, said the voice. Now let's see if you're as good as Crew says you are.
The voice faded into a rising hash of static, and Loken pressed himself against the nearest rock pillar. Smooth where exposed to the wind, pitted where centuries of atmospheric pollutants had eaten away at the rock, the mass of stone was immense and loomed like the leg of a titanic war engine. He eased his head around its rounded corner, switching between variant perceptual modes. None of the spectra through which his helm cycled could penetrate the fog. Loken suspected deliberate artifice in its occluding properties. Something moved ahead of him. A half-glimpsed shadow of a cowled warrior with a swagger of complete confidence. Loken stepped away from the rock and gave chase. The brittle shale of the ground made stealth impossible, but that handicap would work against his enemy too. He reached where he thought the shadow had gone, but there was no sign of his quarry. The mists swelled and surged, and the crag towers of the Seven Neverborn loomed in the fog as if advancing and retreating. Whispering voices sighed through the vox static, names and long lists of numbers, tallies of things long dead. Echoes of a past swept away by a cataclysmic tide of war and unremembering. None were discernible, but the sound struck a mournful chord in Loken. He kept still, filtering out the voices and trying to hear the telltale scrape of armor on stone, a footstep on gravel, anything that might reveal a hidden presence. Given the nature of the man he was here to find, he wasn't holding out much hope.
"You've forgotten what Chthonia taught you," said the voice. It burbled up through the static in his helm, no use for pinpointing a location.
"Maybe you remember a little too much," replied Loken.
"I remember that it was kill or be killed."
"Is that what this is?" said Loken, moving as slowly and quietly as he could.
"I'm not going to kill you," said the voice, "but you're here to try and get me killed, aren't you?"
A flicker of movement in the mist to his right. Loken didn't react, but gently eased his course towards it.
"I'm here because I need you," said Loken, finally understanding the nature of this place. "The Knights Errant? This is where you trained them to become the Grey Ghosts, isn't it?"
"I taught them all," said the voice, "but not you. Why is that?"
Loken shook his head.
"I don't know."
"Because you are the warrior who stands in the light," said the voice, and Loken couldn't decide if the words were meant in admiration or derision. "There's nothing I can teach you."
The blurred outline of the cowled warrior stood in the lee of a gigantic stone pillar. Confident, he went unobserved. Loken held him loose in his peripheral vision, moving as though unaware of his presence. He closed to within 5 paces. He would never get a better chance. Loken leapt towards the source of the taunting voice. The hooded man's outline came apart like ash in a storm.
"Over there, Garvey!"
Loken turned on the spot, in time to see an umbral afterimage of a man moving between two of the Seven Neverborn across the summit. Loken caught a flash of skin, a tattoo. Not the cowled man. Whose voice was he hearing? Was he chasing ghosts? The legends of the Neverborn were garish, scare stories of outrageous hyperbole, like those recounted in the Chronicles of Ursh. They spoke about phantom armies of killing shadows, mistborn wraiths, and nightmares that clawed their way from men's skulls. But that wasn't what Loken was up against. Cracks in his memory and a silent hunter were his foes here.
"You're going back, aren't you? To Lupercal's lair."
Loken didn't waste breath, wondering how the nature of his mission could already be known. Instead, he opted to prick his opponent's vanity.
"You're right," he said, "and I need your help to get in."
"Getting in's the easy part. It's getting out that's going to be a problem."
"Less of a problem if you join me."
"I don't make a habit of going on suicide missions."
"Neither do I."
No reply was forthcoming, and Loken considered his options. As he saw it, he had two. Continue blundering around the mist-shrouded mountain top while being made to look a fool, or leave empty-handed. He was being tested, but tests only worked if both participants worked towards a common goal. Loken had already played one game without knowing the rules. The Wolf King had beaten him to learn something of his character, but this felt like someone taking pleasure in belittling him. If Loken couldn't play by someone else's rules, he'd play by his own. He turned towards the Valkyrie. The aircraft was invisible in the mists, but its transponder signal was a softly glowing sigil on his visor. Abandoning any pretense of searching the mountaintop, he marched brazenly back to the assault carrier.
"Malkador and his agents were thorough in their recruitment of knights errant," said Loken. "There's no shortage of warriors I can assemble in time to make our mission window."
Loken heard stealthy footsteps in the shale, but resisted the obvious bait. The Valkyrie emerged from the fog, and Loken switched the Vox link to Rasua's channel.
"Spool up the engines," he said. "We're leaving."
"You found him?"
"No, but put that hunter's eye upon me."
"Understood."
The footsteps sounded again, right behind him. Loken whipped round, drawing his weapon and aiming it in one fluidly economical motion.
"Don't move," he said.
But there was no one there. Before Loken could react, a pistol pressed against the back of his helmet. A hammer pulled back with a sharp snap of oiled metal.
"I expected more from you," said the voice behind the gun.
"No, you didn't," said Loken, lowering his own pistol.
"I expected you to try a little longer before giving up."
"Would I ever have found you?"
"No."
"So what would be the point?" said Loken. "I don't fight battles I can't win."
"Sometimes you don't get to choose the battles you fight."
"But you can choose how to fight them," said Loken. "How's that hunter's eye, Rasua?"
"I have him," said Rasua. "Say the word, and I can put a turbo penetrator through his leg. Or his head. It's your choice."
Loken slowly turned to face the man he had come to find. Armoured in pitted and scarred gunmetal armour without insignia, he went without helm, and his bearded face was matted with dust. A draconic glyph tattoo coiled around his right eye, the mark of the Blackbloods, one of Chthonia's most vicious murder gangs. Loken saw rugged bone structure that mirrored his own.
"Severian," said Loken, spreading his hands. "I found you."
"By giving up," said Severian. "By changing the rules of the hunt."
"You of all people ought to know that's how a lunar wolf fights," said Loken. "Understand your foe and do whatever is necessary to bring him down."
The warrior grinned, exposing ash-stained teeth.
"You think your assassin friend can hit me?" "She won't."
"If not her, then me," said Loken, bringing his pistol up.
Severian shook his head and flipped something towards Loken, something that glittered silver and metallic.
"Here," said Severian. "You'll need these."
Loken instinctively reached up as Severian stepped away from him.
"And I had such high hopes for you, Garviel Loken."
The mist closed around him like a cloak. Loken didn't pursue. What would be the point? He opened his palm to see what Severian had thrown him. Two gleaming silver discs. At first, Loken thought they were lodge medals, but when he turned them over and saw they were blank and mirror-reflective, he understood what they were. Chthonian mirror coins. Tokens to be left on the eyes of the dead.